What's up, guys? This is John Micah.
Wait, did you start it?
Yeah. Did you not see the countdown?
Oh. No, I didn't. Well, this is perfect then. This is James.
With a dramatic pause.
Yeah.
Welcome to Rockin'
so
a Hard
Place. Podcasting. Welcome to Rockin' a Hard Place.
Welcome back to another episode of Rockin' a Hard Place. We're glad you guys are here. James, what do we have today?
Oh, man. Well, today we're going to talk about some of our road games. You got to have a solid road game strategy when you're on the road and all you do is drive for like 4 days straight. You know, when you're trying to get from Texas to like, you know, Maine to play a concert, You got to have a strategy. You got to have
those
a strategy.
Those are not close
together.
So we
made up.
Yeah.
No, they're not. But we've had to do stuff like that before. And so we used to make up games all the time to like pass the time on the bus and stuff. And our hours spent walking around malls and different cities and stuff. We used to play all these games to get on each other's nerves and mainly try and get you to react. That was the goal the whole time.
So the backstory here is that I never liked playing road games. I thought they were dumb.
True.
And they were usually highly invasive to just, like, travel's hard enough as it is without picking on each other. You know what I mean? Like, I just wanted to like get where
That's
we were going.
One way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to get where we're going in peace and with as little drama as possible. Just flight delays and flat tires and all of those things are enough drama for me. I didn't need any more drama. However, the rest of the band usually like to entertain with a bit more drama.
We loved antagonizing each other, especially like me and Dave and Jeff and Nick too. But like me and Dave and Jeff in particular would like really try and get after each other.
The games got most out of hand. Yeah. During that era.
Yes, for sure. There was this one time in particular, Dave and I were walking along behind Jeff in an airport and Jeff had just bought this, by the way, for listeners who are like, who are these names you're throwing out here? Cutlass has had a handful of different band members over the years. And we'll talk to some of those people as the episodes come out. You'll get to know, you'll hear the backstory. These two guys in particular both grew up down in Southern Oregon with you, and you actually knew Jeff for quite a long time growing up, right?
Yeah, all the way since, probably high school.
Totally, yeah. And he would come, or you came to their house for like Bible studies during the week and stuff like that?
Yeah, their parents had a high school Bible study. I think it was on Friday nights, and so we'd all come and hang out at their house. And and his older brother, Seth, and I were buddies too. And
right.
Yeah. So we ended up being at their house a ton back in high school days. And Jeff played drums in like worship band at church. And in fact, funny story, the first band that I was ever in.
Oh, say it. I can't wait. Say it.
I don't know if I should because
I think you should.
It's self-incriminating here.
It is, but it's so cute.
I know.
So cute.
So I think I was in fifth grade, so probably 11 years old, something like that ish.
Yeah.
And one of the worship pastors at the church decided to put together a kids worship band. And that worship band included myself and it included Jeff Gilbert, who was like a couple years younger than me. So he's probably like in third grade at the time. And
Well, he's younger than me and I'm 2 years younger than you. So
yeah. So maybe he was like in second grade or something. I don't know. It was,
he
was,
he must
young.
Have been like seven or eight.
Yeah. And then there was a few other kids that, you know, from the youth group there and they put this whole band together. I did not get to choose the band members or the band name. But the band name was the Little Levites.
The Little Levites. Oh my gosh.
And
that's
the big culmination of our you know, we practiced together and worked on a set. We finally got to play like a Sunday morning.
Little Levites. I'm sorry. That got me again. Go ahead. Continue.
We finally got to play on a Sunday morning for the big service. And awesome. Yeah, it was ridiculous. It was so funny.
That's that amazing. So Jeff Gilbert then grew into his musical prowess in the band Seven Places that he started with his brother, and they toured. And Dave, our former bass player, was also in Seven Places with them. So Dave and Jeff joined our band right around the Strong Tower era. We had just gotten started on putting that record out, and Dave and Jeff started touring with us. So we would torment each other on the road all the time. We were like a bunch of silly hooligans, basically. Yeah. But there was this one day in particular, Dave and I were walking along behind Jeff in an airport as we were all trying to get to our next gate. And Jeff had just bought a magazine at like one of those Hudson News stores, and he was going to sit down and read this magazine on the flight. And we, Dave and I, were sitting in a pair of plane seats, like a row behind Jeff or a few rows behind him or something like that. And as we got on the plane, Dave was like, "Oh man, I didn't bring a book or anything." I was like, "Ask Jeff for his magazine." And he goes, "He just bought it." And I was like, "Just ask him for it anyway." And so he's like, "Hey, can I borrow your magazine?" And Jeff was very gracious and handed it over. "Here you go, buddy." You know, probably.
Well, because Jeff was just going to fall asleep anyways. That's what he would. He'd get on the airplane and just crash out.
What people don't know is that is Jeff Gilbert's secret power. Just
sleeping.
The fastest sleeper you've ever seen. But also night terrors. And we'll get into that when we have him on for an episode. He would literally have these dreams that he was trapped in like a trash compactor and he'd be screaming and clawing his way out of his bunk. Pretty awesome.
So scary.
Anyway,
when you're on a bus.
So we're getting
on
this plane. Very scary. You're right. So we get on this plane and I was like, ask Jeff for his magazine. So then we're sitting a few rows behind him. And I can't remember if it was my idea or Dave's idea, but the two of us, these horrible friends, we decided it would be funny if we ripped every single page out of the magazine. But then we put it back together, all in order. But we ripped every single page
out.
None
was attached.
None. And so this whole flight, we're sitting there and, you know, like there's kind of a little bit of like murmur and there's some din in the cabin of the plane as people are getting ready and taking off and flying. But usually about like once we get up in the air, the, you know, chatter kind of goes down and people fall asleep. But for like the next 15 minutes, all you could hear was
and I remember that because I was one of the people sitting a few rows ahead and going, who is
what
just
are they doing
tearing ripping pages out of something?
You didn't
and then
assume
I realized
that
it was you guys. Well,
oh, okay.
I did figure it out was you guys, and then I thought Dave was just doing it to be obnoxious audibly. I didn't realize that he was actually pranking Jeff.
No, we were being obnoxious. No, we were being obnoxious for a point.
Yes.
It wasn't just because. It wasn't random obnoxiousness. It was just planned out. So anyway, at the end of this flight, we gave him his magazine back. And I think we broke his heart, to be totally honest. He was so upset. And he just literally threw it away in the garbage. And we were like, what? It's all there.
I remember watching him come off the plane. Like, because he woke up like when we landed. Had no clue. And Dave handed it back to him. And he just got this like,
he was
really,
so disappointed
like,
in us.
Yeah. He had this look of like betrayal on his face. And he just hardly said anything and then just threw it in the trash.
Walked
on the
right
way out of the
to a trash can and flump, just dropped it in there. We also used to do fun stuff where everyone was laughing. We had this game called Batman Eyes. Do you remember us playing this game?
I do, and in fact, I remember it getting so out of hand that eventually we had to make a no Batman eyes on stage rule because it was messing with our live show.
That's right. There was a moratorium on this game when we were playing concerts. We said, no more. We got to stop this. But Batman eyes, basically, if the listener will do this with me, if you turn your hands upside down and make like spectacles and then place them on your face with the spectacle holes like over your eyes, and then, you know, your hands are turned down, it basically looks like a Batman mask on your face. And we called this game Batman Eyes. And what we would do is we would like wait until someone was not looking, and then we'd make the Batman mask face, the Batman eyes, and be like, hey Jeff. And when he glances over at you, the rules were this: if you make eye contact with the person who's doing Batman eyes, you have to lay down on the ground immediately, wherever you are. So yes, we were doing this to each other as we were like walking across like crosswalks going from one side of a busy street to another
in places like New York City.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That would be like the pinnacle. Like, can we get you to lay down in the middle of a street in New York City?
That's right. And then it got out of hand, and we were doing it on stage, and you pulled us aside one night and you were like, okay, look, can you just not do this on stage? Just don't do it when we're playing, please.
Yeah.
Because you kept looking around and we'd be like laying down, right?
The whole band is like laying down on stage, and I'm going, what is happening right now? And then I realized you guys were still playing Batman Eyes on stage.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, gosh, we need to be a little bit professional on stage.
Like, we were so professional. To come see us. What are you talking about? Batman is very professional.
Yeah. But I do remember a few times it was like muddy, or like, you know, we play a festival and be all muddy and wet, and somebody would have to lay down in the mud.
Just gross. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Just you try to find the most inopportune times to make someone lay down. And it was everyone pretty much stuck to it. Don't remember not doing it.
Well, besides you.
Yeah, because I made it up front. I was like, I'm not playing because I don't need the stress.
Yeah. No, we had an honor code for sure. It was like, no, we're doing this for the sake of humor. For the sake of humor, we're doing it. It was great fun. We had a bunch of other games, but one thing we also used to do to each other a whole lot, because, you know, we're traveling a lot, so we basically always have like suitcases with us everywhere we're going. And we would play this game where we would purposely knock each other's suitcases.
I did play this
over.
Game. I joined
That's
in
true.
On this
I
one.
Saw you have I some actually, good ones.
I actually thought this one was funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a kick out of it.
But okay, so you explain your point of view. What is that game and how do we play it? What's the best case scenario you're looking for to tip someone else's suitcase over?
Most of the time it was just to like kind of make them crash and burn when, you know, you're at the airport, you got a bunch of luggage, and you just kick the suitcase and flip it over, and it totally, I mean, I've had that happen. Just, you know, you come off a curb
walking
and it flips
by
over
yourself
on you.
Exactly.
And you're just like, oh my goodness, like it just foils everything you're trying to do, and you got to get everything all turned back over. And so we would start doing
especially
this to
when
each
you
other.
Also have like a guitar on your shoulder, and like you have your pedal board dragging in the other hand, and like if someone gets you kind of off balance with your bag that you're dragging, suddenly everything's slipping off your shoulder, everything's falling off,
and then it's just a disaster. And then you got to put everything all right again, get all loaded up, and you get going again, and then somebody else comes in and train wrecks you again. And it was pretty harmless, but you know, it was a way for us to antagonize one another, and it was actually pretty funny. And all it took was just a quick little flip of the foot, you know, and you turn somebody's suitcase over. But then it started to escalate, as all games tend to, right? Like, it starts out just trying to mess them up a little bit. Ha ha, it was kind of funny. They got to get all their gear back together. But then, like all of the other games, it was like, I wonder if I could actually knock this out of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would cause an even bigger situation. And that continued to grow until we would get to places like elevators, and you try and knock it out of their hands, and then have the elevator doors close so their suitcase is on the outside and they're on the inside.
I think you were the master at that. I'm pretty sure you got that one to happen a couple of times.
Yeah, just kick it real fast and it goes out and the doors close, and they're like, no, so now perfect. I got to go all the way back down and go get my suitcase, and it's just sitting there.
I had a really good one with Dave when we were in Atlanta Airport, I think. So we were walking around, and it's, you know, it's not like a full size suitcase. It's one of those ones that would fit up in the overhead.
Yeah, carry on size. Yeah.
Seats. Yeah, carry on size, but like a four wheeler, just roller. And we're walking through the airport. And if any of our listeners have ever been to the Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson Airport, which is one of the most busy airports in the world, it is a massive facility, and you've got to take these trains to different parts of the terminals that are spread out all over the property. And then you're coming up from the underground area on these tall, like super long escalators. Like, I don't know, no exaggeration, probably at least four stories, right?
It's huge. Yeah. It's possibly the longest escalator I've ever seen anywhere.
They're scary, kind of, to me. I'm like kind of nervous about heights, and they're a little bit, you get up there and you're like, ooh, this is high. This is really high.
If you actually pay attention and look down all the way to the bottom, you go, that is a very long escalator.
And as a person who's kind of scared of heights, I can't help it. I always look and I'm like, ooh, I get the heebie-jeebies, man. But dude, we were about to go down one, to go down to these trains to probably go to another terminal or even baggage claim or something. And man, it was just queued up perfectly. I was behind him in the right kind of interval, spacing behind him. And I could tell that he wasn't really being vigilant, as we all should in Cutlass when there's games afoot. And I just kind of took a couple running steps ahead to catch up to him, and I kicked his suitcase as hard as I could, and it flew out of his hand. Thankfully, nobody was on this escalator below him for the next four stories, but this thing just went like went sliding down this escalator. And Dave is probably one of the best sports about this kind of stuff. He just stood there and took it and laughed. He was so flabbergasted, and we were all just cracking up because of the sound this suitcase made sliding down all that. It was so loud.
It was so loud, and it was moving so fast by the time it got to the bottom.
Velocity for sure.
And then it skidded across the floor. And I remember there was a bunch of guys in like business suits waiting for the train. And it just slid right out, right at their feet. They just saw this suitcase come screaming down the escalator.
Well, they heard it too. I'm sure they like looked up and were like,
because it slid probably, I don't know, 20, 30 yards past, you know, once it hit the ground past the escalator.
You think yards?
It went pretty far. It was flying. And,
medal that day, that's for sure.
Yeah. And they were all, the businessmen looked so annoyed. And then Dave just walked right up to it, scooped it up, kept on walking like nothing had even happened.
Yeah.
And he had this little smirk on his face.
That's right. Totally play the straight man. That's like a perfect, that's a
totally
perfect
meant to
way
do
to
that.
Play that. Just pick it up and don't say anything. Don't laugh. Don't smile.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. That was, that's if you funny. Ever go, so I was actually at the Atlanta airport last week. And I was going down that exact same escalator, and I looked over, and there was a ton of people on it this time, but I looked over at it and I thought, I remember seeing that suitcase. It made me think of it as I was riding down. I thought, oh my goodness, I cannot believe that James said that suitcase all the way down this entire escalator.
Yeah.
So next time you guys are, if anyone listening ends up in the Atlanta airport, when you go down the big long escalator to those trains, you'll know what we're talking about. And
that's
it'll make you laugh.
That's right. That's a little bit of Cutlass history for you there. You can go take your picture with it. Be like, I went to the spot where the suitcase.
There we go.
What were you doing in the Atlanta airport a couple weeks ago?
I actually flew out to do a solo show, just me and my acoustic guitar and a keyboard.
Nice. Cool.
Did an event with the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association at the Billy Graham Library. Then also Samaritan's
Purse in Charlotte.
Was part of it. Mm-hmm. Yep. So it was in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was Bikers with Boxes. So we had a whole bunch of, I think they said like 1,200 motorcycles. Guys came in, bunch of bikers, and they were packing those Christmas boxes for Operation Christmas Child.
Christmas Child.
Yeah. So I think I heard it was something around 6,600 boxes they got boxed up in that one day.
Nice.
Pretty
That's
cool.
Awesome.
So, yeah,
that's a really cool ministry. I mean, all of our listeners, you should check that out. It's a great thing to do. The holidays are coming up. I'm sure you can contact the BGEA and Operation Christmas Child and be a part of that. It's very cool.
Yeah. And if not this year, there's always next year.
That's right.
Always next year.
That's right.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about Cutlass history and, you know, kind of in the first couple episodes, we talked about kind of the beginnings of Cutlass and how the band started. I think it's important, though, kind of as we continue to move on and telling kind of the big story, to kind of hear about our own personal stories, how we grew up, how we got into music, how we ended up in Cutlass, right? Like, so kind of the pre-Cutlass story, the personal bio. Right. It really affects who we are and how we approached music and how we approached our career. And I think you and I now at this point in our lives, we're starting to realize maybe more than ever how much our childhood and upbringing really sculpted the way that we move through life, through much of our career, both for the good and the bad, right?
Definitely.
So,
and things that I'm, you know, challenged by today and things that I'm working through today. And I know that's true for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So today, it'd be awesome, James, if you want to just jump in. I think the listeners would be really interested to hear about some of the challenges that you went through growing up. You have kind of a unique, very, you know, our stories are like almost polar opposite of the way that we grew up.
True.
And it's really funny how, even in the way that we interact, right, and with our personalities and stuff, there's a lot of things that are so different from one another. But those things together can oftentimes be really wonderful because it just strengthens. Like, there's people that you can talk to and minister to and relate to in ways that I never could, and vice versa, right? And so it's I think even though there's a lot of hard stuff in the past, there's also a lot of that allows us to be able to relate to people, I guess. And I think that is a huge benefit when you're trying to share with people and just understand what they're going through and be in there and just trying to help them. And why don't you jump into your story?
Yeah, absolutely. And we had discussed, you know, as we were getting started on this podcast, we want to be deep and open and vulnerable and honest with you guys about the kinds of things we've experienced, because frankly, a lot of the things that we have seen and gone through are things that everyone else has experienced too. And that's, you know, that's the beauty of like songwriting and offering up music and stuff. I think we can tell stories about what it feels like to be brokenhearted, or even stories to feel about like what it feels like to be filled with joy and to feel like, you know, you're inspired and things like that. There's all sorts of emotions that music can convey. And as we set out to do this podcast, we knew that we wanted to invite people to be a part of a discussion where we're urging people to have a healthy reconstruction of their faith rather than a deconstruction moment, to experience, you know, true accountability and true discipleship together. Those are the things that we're really eager to accomplish as we share these stories with the podcast. And they're going to be like funny, crazy stories as well. And some stories that are like so weird, it'll blow your mind, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But we thought that it would be helpful to kind of share our life stories, our background, kind of the history of James and the history of John Micah, especially as we move forward, just for kind of setting context. You know, I think our listeners may understand us better and also kind of hear themselves in our stories, you know. So I just wanted to get started by saying, first of all, to some of our listeners, I'm going to be talking about my childhood, which included child abuse. I was abused for several years of my childhood. And so I know that some people may be sensitive to hearing about stories like that and could be too much for you. So just a little heads up, but I wanted to set the scene by describing what my early years were like and when I found music and when I found God and when I met John Micah and when God commissioned us to start going around the world to share the gospel as we shared in episode one. So I actually grew up over on the East Coast. I was born in a town called Danbury, Connecticut. And by the way, feel free to ask me questions as we go, John Micah. Like it might help explain other things, you know? Yeah, good. Okay.
Yeah.
So I grew up on the East Coast. I was born in Danbury, which is right near Ridgefield, Connecticut. And then we lived in Ridgefield my childhood up until age 11. And Ridgefield was a pretty cool little town, to be totally honest. It was like one of those, like, really, as far as my memory goes, really idyllic kind of East Coast towns, really close to New York City. You know, we had awesome pizza. We were always playing baseball and there was hockey and we had snow days and all sorts of just fun, like East Coast stuff. There was also, you know, one of the major battles of the Revolutionary War was fought there, the Battle of Ridgefield. So we had fun parades and stuff growing up too, where there would be like reenactments and stuff. I always thought that was really beautiful and really fascinating. And, you know, growing up in the early 80s, it was a time of life where I could literally like get on my bike and be gone all day long riding around town with my friends and going to the comic book store, or going to the baseball field and playing baseball and come home when it got dark and not have to explain myself at all. That was just what life was like back then.
So Stranger Things is real?
Yes. Yes, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is exactly what it felt like. And that's one of those things I really love about that show. Anyway, so, you know, my mom had moved up there with her family. They're originally from Texas. My mom grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas, right on the coast, down in the Gulf. And they had moved up to the East Coast because my grandpa got transferred for his job. And so my mom was up there after high school and as a young adult and started, you know, working as a waitress and waiting tables and stuff. And she met my dad at this restaurant in Ridgefield, Connecticut called The Ancient Mariner. So like a seafaring kind of theme. Like there were like nets on the walls with like fake plastic starfish and like crabs and stuff.
I'm assuming like they served seafood there. Is it?
Oh yeah. 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 It was a seafood restaurant. Yeah. From what I remember, I think I'm right about that. So The Ancient Mariner is where my mom, whose name is Janice, my mom met my dad, Bob Mead. And Bobby grew up in upstate New York and, you know, was a total East Coast kid. He had been, I think I mentioned this in one of the previous episodes, but he was a really talented chef from a pretty young age. In fact, had worked at the Lake Placid Olympics in 1980. And so this was right before I was born and met my mom there in Ridgefield. And, you know, then I was born. And yeah, so the early years of our life, I was one when my dad left our family. He had had an affair and was really conflicted about it. It was this crazy sort of turn of events. To be totally honest, I really think that his brokenness from his relationship with his father growing up broke his heart in such a way that he felt like he just couldn't be a good dad, couldn't be a good husband. And he had, like, he put so much pressure on himself. And I don't think he, at the time, had enough courage to try and work it out with my mom. And they were both really young and, you know, they didn't have a relationship that was founded in Christ. So there wasn't that unifying presence of God and his peace in their marriage. So it was just hard and it was just turmoil. I was one and he left. So I didn't really grow up with my dad around. I grew up seeing him once a year for my whole life. And eventually he moved away to Nashville, Tennessee, where I would go visit him. So imagine this too. This is crazy. I was 5 years old when I went on my first flight by myself from LaGuardia down to Nashville. And I would never put my 5-year-old on a plane by themselves now. Like, that is insane to me. But yeah, I flew as an unaccompanied minor all the time. Back then it was like Pan Am and, you know, TWA and planes like that.
Hopefully that no one was kicking your suitcase over while you were...
No, but I did see some gnarly things as a young traveler, just being alone all the time. Yeah. And of course I would be escorted by, you know, airline personnel from everywhere. And I was always being supervised, but you know, they're not like sitting with you the whole time. So, but yeah, you know, so I grew up really missing my dad. I wanted him there and he lived far away. And, I grew up visiting him once a year. Around age 6, my mom met this guy who became part of our life. And from age 6 to age 11, he was in my life. He eventually married her. But from age 6 to age 11, he was a part of our life and, very, very physically abusive to me, in secret though. I think that often with a person like that, who is a predator, he was tormenting my mom and I in very different ways, and he was keeping us isolated in our own torment, so to speak. And part of his motive, part of his MO, I guess, was to not only to prey upon my fear and to try and hurt me, but also to completely control our environment. That area was really, really expensive to live in. So we were pretty poor and we just had apartments and stuff. My mom was actually working 3 jobs and going to school at Western Connecticut to try and become a teacher so she could kind of break us out of that life cycle, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was just, it was me and him alone a lot. There was kind of this expectation to follow these rules that were very harsh. And I would say age 6, age 7 for me. Well, first of all, that's a really confusing thing for a 6 or 7-year-old to try and be processing. Like, to be honest, at the time, I really wanted a dad, like a father figure in my life. I wanted someone to be a daddy to me, you know, and I really wanted this guy to like me. I really wanted his approval. And so for the age 6, age 7, I really felt like I was trying to just like figure out what the rules were. Right.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much like, you know, as soon as I got home from school, I was supposed to start cooking dinner. Yeah. And if I didn't have dinner ready by the time he got home, I would get hurt for that.
So as a 7-year-old kid, you have to by yourself figure out dinner and cook it and have it ready to go by the time that he got home. And if that wasn't ready, you would be punished for that.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like make me a sandwich. It was like
dinner.
I had to like roast a chicken and like make mashed potatoes and like make a salad. Yeah. And thankfully
I don't think my 18-year-old son could do that right now.
You know, I'll say this. I am a pretty good cook nowadays and I've had a lot of experience. I did grow up cooking a lot of stuff. One way my dad, Bob Mead, came in pretty clutch as a talented chef was I would call him sometimes. I'd be like,
"Oh, there you go.
I have to cook this. How do I do this?" And he would tell me over the phone how to cook. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that was like kind of the rules I had to follow in life. And you know, obviously what's not being said about that is like, I'm a kid. I want to come home from school and like have free time to play and, you know, get my steam out from being at school all day. And like, I had to go right into like making sure the house was clean, starting to cook dinner. Like part of what became so frustrating over the years was I felt like he robbed my childhood from me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you couldn't just be a kid and have fun. You had to, and you're living in fear because if you don't do it perfectly, you physically suffer for it.
Right. And he would come home and first thing he would do is go touch the TV. Now, a lot of our younger listeners are like, why did he touch the TV? Well, our old TVs used to get real hot when we would watch them. You remember that? Big old TVs with tube.
Big CRT tube in them, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So he would go over and touch the TV and see if it was warm. And even if I had the house clean and there was dinner on the table, if that TV was warm, I would get in trouble for that because that meant I was obviously not doing what I was supposed to, even if there was proof in front of him that I did, in fact, follow the rules. So like it was oppressive and there were times
and when you say you get in trouble for it, it's not like you got like a normal spanking. Like it was very abusive, correct?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he would hit me and hurt me and he was rough with me and harsh and mean. And he would yell at me and belittle me and smack me around, push me down, force me to, cower in fear in front of him. Yeah. And honestly, I really resisted too. Like I did not want to let him see me cower in front of him. And so, as I determined how to like figure out his rules and navigate around him, I started to develop this kind of strategy for like, almost like an empath, like I would kind of sense where his mood was at or where it could lead to. And I would try and kind of control the vibe of the house really. And other than that, my survival strategy was to try and be as invisible as possible, not be around, not be in the way. I would leave him alone as much as I could without drawing attention to myself for not being there too. That was part of it that was so tricky. There was this fine line that I had to weave in and out of,
I'm here. I did all the things. Now I'm going to disappear.
Right, right. But the moment he thinks, where's James? I better be there. Because then otherwise I'd be in trouble for not being there. It was just ridiculous. Yeah. I remember one night in particular, I had a cold and I was coughing at night. And, normally like we have children, if you hear your child coughing at night and you know that they're up and they're sick and they're not feeling well, you want to go comfort them. You want to go help. You want to offer them a solution to help them feel a little better. Here, maybe take this medicine. Here, maybe we turn on the humidifier so it's not so dry in here. Stuff like that. You want to help, right? So I'm coughing, I'm sick, and it's the middle of the night, and he walks in my room, and he sat down on my bed, and he looked at me, and he said, "You are keeping me up, and I know that you are just trying to get attention from your mom right now, and we're not having it. This is not okay." Like he was kind of gruff with me for a few minutes.
Yeah.
And then he just sat there and looked at me and I coughed again and he punched me in the chest. And I coughed again a couple moments later and he punched me in the chest again and literally sat on my bed. And every time I would cough, he would punch me in the chest. He'd be like, cussing at me and stuff like you stop it. Mm-hmm. And so I'd literally got to a point where I was just like holding it in and choking it back. That's what it was like. That's what it was like, man. Mm. Around age 8, my strategy started to sharpen and develop. I came up with this plan. I basically said to myself, okay, this is a full-grown man. You are not able to fight him off. But if you can keep him out of here, and I'm listeners can't see this, but I'm pointing to my mind right now, pointing to my brain. If I can keep him out of my mind, then I win, right? If I can keep him from getting in here and messing with me psychologically, then I win. And this really came from, as I looked at the world around me, especially in that part of the country, like we went to the city fairly often. I saw a lot of strange people in the subway and at, on the streets and stuff. And as I looked at the world around me, I started to realize that a lot of people that grew up being victimized and preyed upon either became people that were also monsters themselves that were trying to hunt and hurt people, or they became this like permanent victim as like part of their identity. And that to me was more terrifying than the next moment he would physically hurt me. The fact that he might change me permanently for the future was, that made me so scared. And so I thought to myself, okay, I'm not going to let him in here. I'm not going to let him in my head. I'm going to keep him out. I'm stronger than him up here. And at the same time, I kept thinking, all right, he's a full-grown man, but he's not growing anymore, and I am. And I was like, you just wait, mister. I am coming for you. And so I just kind of told myself to bide my time, you know? And at this time, we happened to live right next door to the public library in Ridgefield. There's probably still this house sitting there on Main Street in Ridgefield, Connecticut. It's this big white house, and it's a very, very old house, and it was turned into apartments, and we lived there for some time. But right next door to us was the public library, and I would go to the library so much. I was there all the time, and I would just grab like the dictionary, and I would read the dictionary and try and memorize words, and I would read like full sets of encyclopedias, and I would just like try and remember all this stuff. Or if I heard adults talking about some famous novel, I would go grab that off the shelf, and like I would be reading War and Peace at 8 years old, like I knew what I was reading. But really, like, I was just trying to convince myself that I was keeping him out of here, and it worked. It was a strategy that helped me feel safer at the very least. But his control and his abuse continued. It was rough. So I'll fast forward a bit, but, age 11, we're now living in a different part of Ridgefield, the Casagmo townhomes. I don't know what they're called, but Casagmo apartments. It was like this big sprawling apartment complex with all these townhouses and stuff. And we lived there. And my best friend, Derek, lived across town, and he and his family were pretty well off and had a really, really nice house. And I hung out with him all the time. And it was like a safe place for me. And his mom and my mom were good friends, but it was like pretty much on the other side of town. And there was woods in between us, and there was a bunch of streets and a bunch of like different shopping complexes you had to weave in and out and around to like get to that side of town and get over to his house. But we lived over there, and I was recently talking to my mom about this because I wanted to make sure I had the details of this right as I endeavored to talk about this with our listeners. But I wanted to talk to my mom about this because maybe if you're listening, maybe you've felt this way before. I am now dealing with this kind of trauma from my childhood in a healthy way as an adult. I'm in therapy. I'm talking to my therapist about these kinds of moments and the psychological warfare of these kinds of moments in my life, and the things that I developed as coping strategies at the time that were helpful, and the things that I developed as strategies at the time that are now no longer helpful and kind of actually counterproductive to me as an adult man who is safe and has a trusting, loving relationship and has a different agenda in my life. So these are no longer helpful things at this point. Yeah. So I'm doing the work of talking through it and talking about it and praying. And I have great friends like you. Praise God for you, John Micah. I have great friends that talk to me about these things and listen and pray with me. And you know, thankfully I get to unite with God's people all around the world and do a lot of fun stuff in ministry. But I have experienced, and maybe some of you have too, as I look back on these traumatic events in my past, there's like this cognitive dissonance that happens where I'm like, is that real? Am I remembering that in the real way, or is this just a thing I made up to like help myself deal with the shame and the hurt of abuse? And so I was really trying to like review these things as they happened and make sure that I was accurate about this. But essentially one day when I was 11 years old, we were living in this other part of town. We were living in these other apartments, and my stepfather was being real nasty to me, just real mean, real aggressive in his behavior and his way of talking. And my mom was at the apartment as well. But in my memory, and this is why I wanted to talk to her about it, in my memory, I don't remember her being there. And I actually just spoke to my therapist about this the other day, this specific memory, and talking to my mom about it as an adult. And she said, oftentimes in those moments of trauma, as we recall them, you know, your prefrontal cortex shuts down during those moments when you're dealing with intense trauma, and you really block out a lot of details other than exactly what is the danger right in front of you. And so I remember all of this, but I did not remember that my mom was there. And she told me that she watched this all happen. But basically, my stepdad and I were getting in an argument kind of fight. And like I said, I was really determined to not just like be a coward and just cower in front of him. And so I was like not letting him be this way. So I was kind of like getting back into it with him arguing. And he said something to me. I don't remember this, like what he said, but I snapped and I just punched him in the face, and a nice crunch, a waterfall of blood coming from his nose. And he kind of hit his knees and was like, oh, I turned and ran immediately. I just ran out the door and ran down the stairs. And my mom said that then like they got in an argument about it. So I mentioned my friend a moment ago to tell you guys that when I ran out the door right after doing that, I basically ran through the woods, ran across town, and ran all the way to my friend's house and hid up in his room. And we played with like Transformers or something cool like that.
Yeah. Cause you're like, you're 11 years old right now at this point, 11, right?
Yep. 11. Yeah. Yeah.
Now and, let me ask you something real fast, because I've heard you tell this story, you know, years ago. As I recall, I think the way that I originally heard this story was that you'd punched him in the nose and he fell backwards, hit his head on the table and got knocked out, and then you ran away. Right. Now, having kind of put some of the pieces together, are you finding there might have been some things there that was different in your mind than what happened?
Right. Yes. And that's why I wanted to talk to my mom about this. Yeah. And I was so relieved when she said, well, I was there. I watched it happen. Cause I was like, oh good. I can ask you what happened then. Cause in my mind I was like, well, what happened? I punched him. He fell. I ran away. Those are still kind of the same details, but what I thought
filled in the gaps a little bit.
Yeah. But so what really happened was, you know, whammy, I punched him, crunch went the nose, down came the blood. He fell to his knees, you know, kind of wincing in pain. And I literally just bolted right then and there. Mm-hmm. My mom said he then went to the bathroom and was like in there, like clanging around, trying to get his blood to stop and cleaning up and stuff. And then they got in a big argument about it. By that time, I had made it across town to my friend's house, and his mom called my mom because they were friends. Yeah. So his mom called my mom and she came over at that point. And she told me when we talked about this last week, and I asked her permission to share her perspective as well. So, hi, Mom. Love you. She told me that for some time she had been like this growing suspicion. Something is wrong. Something is happening to James. There's something dangerous happening. But she was also being tormented by this man. And I think in the back of her mind, there was this like mom's intuition and a suspicion that something was wrong and something wasn't right for me. But until that moment, like everything snapped right to the foreground in her mind. I think like until she saw it happen, she was like, oh my gosh. So she came over, because you know, my buddy's mom called her. She came over. I told her everything. We talked about everything. She told me stuff. And we made a plan. She said, okay, we're done with him. I'm going to get a divorce. We're going to leave him. And, there was also a moment where he tried to kidnap me at school the next week, and it just started to get kind of crazy, man. So we stayed with these friends, my friend and his mom, in their beautiful big house. And they were very, very generous. I just keep saying they had this amazing big house, because to me it was like a castle, like, cause I grew up in apartments, right? And I didn't have like a bunch of stuff, but he had like two of every cool toy that you would see in like Toys R Us, and this massive house and a pool, and there was a pond next to them. And I was just like, this is the coolest place ever. You know,
and I found that things looked a lot bigger when I was 11 than they do now.
Totally.
I'm an adult.
Totally. That's right.
Yeah.
So
the Disney castle is a lot smaller now than in my memories.
Totally. Yeah. When you go see the castle at either of the Disney parks, you're like, huh, it's only that big. Huh.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we stayed with them for a few months while school got finished up. And then, man, at the end of fifth grade, and we really didn't tell anybody where we were going, we moved and we left Connecticut and we moved to Ruidoso, New Mexico. That's where my grandparents were living at the time. So my mom's dad, his name is James Gary Castor. I am named after my grandpa. I love him so much. And my grandma, Jackie. So they're living in Ruidoso, New Mexico. And at the time, their daughter, Anna, so my mom's youngest stepsister, Anna, who was a senior in high school. So she was living at home, of course. And we moved in with them. I was in sixth grade now, and Anna was a senior. Unfortunately, this last summer, my Aunt Anna passed away. She had a seizure that caused her to have a major heart attack, and her brain was without oxygen for too long. By the time the paramedics got to her, she was in a coma for about a week, a little bit longer than that, in the hospital, and then passed away. And my family gathered this summer in El Paso to mourn and to be together and to bury Anna. And it was rough, to be totally honest. My mom has, there were four sisters. And so the three of them are very tight and very loving. And I have such a great family. We were living with my grandma and grandpa at this time. So now I'm starting sixth grade. We had just moved from Connecticut. We had just escaped this guy, the chaos, the fear, the control. We had just escaped that. And honestly, New Mexico for me was kind of like a year. I call it the pause button. It felt like I was on pause that whole year, just numb emotionally. I didn't really make a lot of friends that year, which is strange for me because normally I go find friends and I make deep friendships. That's like a thing for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a weird year. And just the logistics of moving away from, you know, the East Coast and a thriving area all around New York City, and then moving to Ruidoso is, first of all, gorgeous. But for an 11-year-old who just came from like New York City, I was like, where are we? There's no buildings here. there's no people here. You know, it was insane. It was a shell shock for me, but I was so grateful to have safety and peace. You know, like my grandparents are lovely, very kind, very sweet, calm, quiet. My grandpa is brilliant. He's always been an amazing man who really leads by example. Like, he's one of those people that doesn't have to like use a lot of words to show you the right way to behave or act. He just shows you, and he loves you, and he loves everyone. And it's really been very impactful in my life now for 40 years. But we got to live with them. And then my mom got her first job as a teacher that year. So now we had the same time off in our year schedule. That summer, she decided, she had just bought a new car that year. She decided we would drive around the country and just like go have fun. So my mom would literally like hand me the Rand McNally Atlas, and we would just choose a route every day. We would choose, and maybe a couple days ahead, we'd be like, oh, we should try and drive, you know, through these states and then get to like Bryce Canyon, for example. We went and saw some of the beautiful parks around the country. I also remember how gracious she was to drive us to Nashville, and I got to spend some time with my dad that summer. She drove us there. I think she stayed in a hotel nearby while I stayed with my dad for a few days. But I always really appreciated, even though they, you know, they divorced and their marriage ended, like they were really respectful about each other and to each other for me. He would call her on Mother's Day. He would call her on birthdays and, you know, say hi to her and hope you're having a great day. You're such a great mom. Thank you for everything you do for our kid. You know, like they had I'm really grateful for that, because that I've seen it be toxic and harsh and weird for a lot of kids, but I didn't have that. I had parents who were very kind about each other to me, and they were kind with each other in front of me. And that was very great. So I got to hang out with my dad a little bit that summer, and then we drove back west and we drove up to Albany, Oregon to visit my Aunt Sheila, Uncle Tom, and my cousin Jocelyn. So Jocelyn and I are the same age. We've talked about her before. I went over to their farm and saw the turkey chicks when we did the hashtag turkey facts.
Oh, that's right, turkey facts.
Episode. So those are her turkeys. And now they've got goats and stuff too. Oh man, the goats are freaking hilarious, man. They're so funny.
That's funny.
So yeah, at the time they were living in Albany, Oregon. And we went to Albany. And frankly, like I just told my mom, wow, it's so beautiful here. Can we just move here? Because I just got one glimpse at the Willamette Valley and I was hooked, you know. Just loved it so much. So my mom,
and for people who don't know James very well, James actually loves gray, cloudy days and rain. It's like,
yes, I do.
His happy place. So that's why the Willamette Valley was like, oh, this is where I want to be.
And this it's is very
and
true.
Green and lush and trees, yes, and all that too. But
it's very true. I do love a gray, gloomy day. I love that so much. But this was summertime. And Oregon, as you know, is magical in the summertime.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to beat in the summer.
Like, whoa, it's beautiful here and everything's green and lush and cool. And, you know, so we stayed that summer with them for some time. And I just kept asking my mom if we can move there. And so she called a school there in Albany, Oregon, and got an interview with them, South Shore Elementary School in Albany, Oregon. And guess what? They hired her. And she had a great career there. She mostly taught like a second and third grade rotation class, where she would get the kids as second graders and have them for their third grade year as well. She did that for the majority of her career, as far as I remember, and retired a few years ago. Great, great career. Made a huge impact. I'm so proud of her. She did an amazing job. Yeah. And actually, one of her last, I think maybe her last class that she had, my best friend, Joe Mendenhall, she had already taught his daughter, Brianna, and then she had Joe's son, Silas, in her class as well. And that was her last, that was like her sayonara class.
Yeah.
But, and yes.
I think I hear Luna's rabbit in the background again.
Yep.
Okay. So you moved to Albany. How old are you when you get to Albany?
Yeah, so I was like 12 now, or about to be 12. Yeah, no, I was 12.
And that would be sixth grade, seventh grade, right in there somewhere.
Yeah, so I did sixth grade in New Mexico, and then I arrived in Albany to start seventh grade, and I was 12 turning 13.
Okay.
Because my birthday's in December, so like I start the school year, you know, September at age 12, and then December I turn 13, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So seventh grade. And to be totally honest, I don't know. I guess I felt like we were far enough away from that traumatic past. Not really like time-wise, but like geographically, we were all the way across the country now. Maybe there was something about it to that. But if New Mexico was the pause button, this was like the fast forward button. Albany... Man, I just started fighting the world around me. Like, I started doing drugs, started stealing liquor to try and be drunk often. And I was getting in fights a lot, and I was just so angry. And I was doing all this in secret and trying to run around and just be, you know, be chaos in the streets of Albany.
The mean streets of Albany.
The mean streets. I had to watch someone litter. Oh man. Well, who is that guy? The guy Kale from Sonnen. Yeah, Kale yeah. Sonnen. There we go.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a UFC fighter. They did the mean streets.
From Westland, Oregon.
Yeah. Which is like a super nice
town. That
was
so funny.
Yeah.
Here. Our listeners should pause right here and go look up the Mean Streets of West Lynn video on YouTube. It's very funny. The former UFC fighter Kale Sonnen made these really funny commercials that were awesome. Anyway, so I'm in Albany, Oregon, 7th grade. I'm kind of, you know, a walking ball of chaos. And it was also that year that let me back up. In Ruidoso, as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old there for 6th grade, I discovered under a bed in the guest bedroom at my grandparents' house, I discovered a guitar case, and I pulled it out and I opened it up, and there was this beautiful electric guitar in there, and it was like the heavens saying, like, oh, you know, like light shone out of this guitar case, and I was like, what is this? And I would strum it a little bit, and then I would like put it away. And I remember I told Anna, my mom's stepsister, Anna. I told my aunt Anna one day, I was like, I found this guitar. And she was like, that's awesome. You should just play it. I'm sure grandma and grandpa are fine with that. And so I went and asked them, and my grandma was like, oh, sure, sweetie, you should just play it. And so I started playing guitar there at their house. That was the first time I started playing electric guitar. Awesome. Side note, they actually brought that guitar to me years later. And I have it. It's like an old like 70s Japanese import under the brand name Norma, and it's a double cutaway body style. It's sort of looks like a Gibson Melody Maker a little bit, but it's got F holes in it, like it's semi hollow body.
Oh, interesting.
My plan is to have it refurbished totally because the neck is like unplayable right now, and I want to have it redone basically. But I want to have it refurbished like. Kind of as OG specs as possible, but nice. Yeah. And eventually want to record it. So that's kind of a project I have in the works with that guitar. So if anyone can help me with that project, reach out, and and I would love to restore this guitar in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, the OG guitar where it all began.
But when we moved to Albany, one of the only productive things I started to do with my time was play guitar. I mowed lawns all summer long and did yard work so that I could buy myself an electric guitar, and started playing guitar, and I would sit in my room and like listen to Metallica and Smashing Pumpkins and stuff like that. And I would just try and like play along, and eventually started a band. And we were like playing shows around the area, and we had a storage unit there in Albany, Oregon, right along the train tracks. And we would play, write songs, rehearse for shows in there in that storage unit. And it was a cool like hangout club basically to invite our friends. And so we did. We had friends hanging out all the time while we would jam.
And you guys were also called the Little Levites in your first band.
Yeah, that's right. No. We were called the Little Evil Lights. No, we were called Custom, also spelled with a K. I guess I've had a thing for being in a band with a K. We were writing our own music and we were playing shows, and it was a blast. That was one of the only productive things I was doing with my time. But we, on my 17th birthday, we played a show, and like I said, I was drinking a lot as a minor, and we had a party after my birthday, and I got alcohol poisoning that night and pretty much felt like I had died. Like it was so painful. I felt like I got hit by a truck. It was just horrible. But I didn't want to go home because I didn't want to be in trouble for that. So I like slept it off for a few days at a couple different friends' houses, which is terrifying. Imagine high schoolers trying to take care of each other in that kind of state. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Asking for trouble. So,
yeah.
Anyway, at that point, I kind of felt like I had hit a real low point in my life. Earlier, I described at age 8, I was like, I don't want my stepdad to change me. I don't want him to make me this permanent victim that's destroying my life and just causing chaos. But look, it was only a few years later and I was doing it. I was that person. Mm-hmm. I had become the thing that I feared. I had become the thing that I secretly despised. And I felt guilty because I knew I was hurting everyone around me. And I just really felt pretty low. I really hated myself around that time. I had these friends at school. I say friends in air quotes because like we weren't hanging out really because, again, I was doing bad stuff and these kids were Christian kids. So hopefully they weren't doing what I was doing. Anyway, they had come to me often at school and just said things like, hey, dude, we love you. Or, hey, dude, we're praying for you. Or they would come to our shows sometimes and just support us. And they were stoked about, you know, and what we were doing. And, you know, I think I played sports with some of them. I played soccer for a long time, like you did. So one week they invited me to youth group and something about it, I was just like, man, I'm miserable. And these guys are always kind and loving. And I really don't understand that. But I think I should go with them. I think there's something different I could be doing with my life. So I went to youth group with them. And South Albany Community Church at the time had a great youth pastor named Rob Nelke. Rob Nelke was preaching that night. And I walked in and the students were singing. They had their hands lifted in the air, praising Jesus. And I had never seen people act like that before. So I thought that was pretty strange because I was like, what are they doing? And then it was like a Disney moment. Like, how do you guys all know these songs? I've never heard these songs before. And, you know, they're
spontaneously
just,
song and dance.
Yeah, man. But then I sat there and I listened, and Rob preached the parable of the prodigal son from Luke 15. And for my life and for what I was doing and for what I was afraid of and what I was dealing with and what I was angry in my heart about, this story unlocked my heart. And I really heard the Holy Spirit. In particular, that story in Luke 15 says that the father was watching and waiting for his son. And he saw him while he was still quite a distance off. This son, of course, had squandered his life away. He had taken his inheritance from his father early and left and gone into the world beyond, into a different country, and had been, you know, partying, had been wasting his money, wasting his life on all of the vices and all of the dangers and temptations of life. And one day he had decided that he had had enough, and he was literally sleeping in mud next to a pigsty and wanted to eat that food because he was so hungry, just this rotting pig food in the trough. He was so hungry and so poor and so destitute, and nobody was helping him anymore because he had burned all of his relationships. And I really felt like this was me at this point in this story. Mm-hmm. But the Bible says something amazing here. It says that the father was watching and waiting for his son, saw him while he was still quite a distance away. And then the father did something remarkable to me. The father in the story runs to meet his son where he is on the road. And he doesn't run out to meet his son to reject him. He doesn't run out there to send him away or to yell at him or to accuse him. He runs out there at the first sign of his return. He runs to him to hug him and hold him close so that they can have presence with each other again. And then, of course, a series of other things that are all symbolic, like the robe and the ring and the feast and all that. Mm-hmm. But what I really love is that the story here, Jesus doesn't really finish the end of this story. He's just told three stories in a row to his audience: lost coins, lost sheep, and a lost son that returns home. And he tells these three stories right in a row, same audience. Everyone's listening to these stories. And you know that they think this last story that's also about something being lost and found, they think that he's about to make his great point because this is the third story in a row that he's telling the same kind of setup. And he doesn't really finish the story. He doesn't wrap it up with resolution. He doesn't really describe the feast and the restoration process of this son back into the community. He just describes this moment where the father and the son walk and talk with each other the rest of the way home. And I love that. But that night, that's where the Holy Spirit spoke to me and said, James, this is my plan for you. I love you. You are my son. And so I made a decision to follow Christ that night, to commit my life to him. I met Lindsay that night. We fell in love. I've been with her ever since. We're about to have our 20-year anniversary in January, and she has changed my life in a lot of ways. She's the most gracious and compassionate person I've ever known. But yeah, that night was remarkable for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I obviously the next day, the very next day, I was perfect. Not true.
Yes.
I slowly started to learn as the Lord showed me over the course of my life up till now, even, and beyond now, as the Lord showed me all the ways that I could give my life back to him and follow him and trust him. But it was a really exciting time of life. One of the next things that happened was also very unfortunate. One of our best friends, a guy in my band, a young kid who was only 19, he was killed in a car accident. It was tragic.
He was the singer of your band. Is that correct? Yeah.
That's right. His name was Casey, and he was just such an amazing kid. He was so funny and so friendly. Honestly, it reminds me of the things that I loved about my dad. One of the things that I think is amazing about my dad was he would look for the people that everyone else would consider misfits. And he would just show them that they were worth his time and that he loved them and he would be their friend. And that's what our friend Casey was like too. He was so kind and so funny and creative and weird and happy, and he just treated everyone like they were his friend. And he literally would like befriend a bunch of the like homeless people around our town and go spend time with them and talk to them. Mm-hmm. And he knew their names, and he was a wonderful person. And it was one of the first things that I went through as like a test in my life of like, do I trust that God is good and that he has a plan, even if this kind of thing happens? You know, and we wrote a song about this years later. Even if the healing doesn't come and life falls apart and things are still undone, you are God, you are good, forever faithful, you know? Yeah. And it was one of those moments, like right away in my faith, where I had to look God in the face and say, I think I trust you with this too, even though this hurts really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after that point, I mean, now you're going to church and you've given your life to Christ. And then it was probably what, a year later or so that we ended up meeting, and then kind of the Cutlass journey began.
That's right. Yeah.
Together.
Yeah. For about a year, I was still in my band. And even after Casey's passing, we continued writing music, and things started to really take shape for us, even to the point where we were getting looked at by some real like major labels and some national touring groups and stuff. But I just really felt in my heart that I was unprepared to go be part of that lifestyle. Like, there was potential talk about my band at the time, like going out on a major tour, opening for a band called Taproot, possibly opening for Linkin Park later that same summer. It was all just like spinning out of control to me. And I was like, I don't think I can go do that. I was in love with Lindsay. I knew very much that I wanted us to be married and that I wanted a life with her. I knew very much that I wanted to give the gift of music back to God. And I knew that that wasn't possible with that group at the time, at the very least. It wasn't what we were doing. There was conflict within our group about how different people felt about that spiritual journey, especially my transformation into a Christian. I felt like I needed to make a decision. I was at a crossroads, and I felt like God was telling me to step down and to listen to him and wait patiently for him to instruct me. So I quit my band, and you guys were already a band up here in Portland.
Yeah.
Two of the guys had grown up in Albany, and they reached out to me right away. I'd love to hear from your perspective. Like, how did they bring this up to you? Like, hey, we know this guy. I think you and I had met already at this point.
Yeah, and it was kind of, I'm trying to remember now, it was so long ago, but we had a different guitarist in the band initially, Andy Morrison, it's funny because now you guys are friends, and
yeah,
you were
Andy
just
and I
at his wedding
friends.
just
That's
recently.
Right. I love him, and I was one of his groomsmen this last weekend. Booyah! Yeah. Congratulations,
so
Andy and Heather.
Yeah. So he left the band, and I think it was during that time that the other guys from Albany were like, had been buddies with you, and I think it was sort of this, like, we've always talked about doing music and, you know, like, we've wanted to be in a band, and he's maybe leaving his band, and, you know, just kind of, I didn't know you. I didn't know, you know, everyone else is like, oh yeah, we got to get this guy in, you know, we got to have him be part of our band. And so it's like, okay, cool. You know, here we go. And we're, you know, we're a bunch of kids. And I think the success kind of local level success that your old band had too kind of had some clout with the other guys of like, he's like,
yeah,
like, their band's like gonna get signed and like they're legit, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, we played at this legendary club in Albany that all of us grew up going to shows at, and it's called the Venetian Theater. Actually, you know what's funny now is I mentioned earlier my best friend Joe Mendenhall, his church bought the Venetian Theater, and that's their church now.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
that's
super
awesome.
Fun. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, my band and, you know, bands that are like huge in Oregon music lore, like Floater, they used to play there all the time. And like, we would get some cool national bands through there too. And it was pretty good music scene in Albany. What I didn't mention was some of those friends of mine that led me to the Lord ended up forming a band as well. They're called Falling Up. And we took them on tour with us when they started putting out music. We're also from Albany. You know, it was a fun town. There was a lot of kids coming to know Jesus at that time when I was in high school. There was a lot of kids who were into music. There were some really talented like skaters and stuff too. It was just like a fun thing going on in Albany, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of, I guess, brings us up to the... connects from childhood up to the beginning.
Episode one, basically.
Yeah, episode one. I think in a future episode, we might be able to kind of unpack your perspective on that today, because I think you're kind of in a new...
Yes, I am.
...new season of life where you're reevaluating that, looking at that kind of...
Yes, exactly.
I've carried this... Yeah, and how has this affected me all the way to where I am today through my whole life? And I think that's probably a whole nother conversation to have. But I would say before we close here, maybe just in like just a short little tidbit of what would you say to someone who is maybe in that dark place that maybe it's a little different than what you were in, but you know that you were in a pretty dark spot with your stepdad, and your mom was in a pretty dark spot, and it just seemed probably hopeless at times, right? And just like there's no way out and it's hopeless. Where you're, you know, through your whole journey and the things now, I think your perspective's probably shifted a bit on what God was doing and what God has done. What would you mm-hmm. say to that person that's maybe in that spot today and right now?
Yeah, I think that it's important to mention that at that time in my life, right around age 8 again, I started to see dreams and visions where God would show me that even though like I didn't go to church and, you know, we weren't praying, I wasn't being raised in the ways of the Lord, I wasn't reading the Bible growing up, but I remember feeling like God would show me from time to time that he was there for me, that he was going to protect me, that he had a plan for peace for me. And so I would say after all these years later and now getting to study God's word, and I do read the Bible and I do pray and I do know Jesus personally, I would say I've looked into the scriptures and I want you to know God does have a plan for you. Jeremiah 29:11 tells us that he has a plan for peace and he knows our future and he wants to lead us. And there's other areas in God's word where he tells us to trust in him with all of our hearts and lean not on our own understanding. Acknowledge him in all of our ways and watch as he directs our paths. I think we need to remember that what is happening to us as the result of humans around us who are also broken people, that is not Jesus. That's not the Lord, right? Like even when that happens in the church, and it's harder to distinguish sometimes in that context, but like the people that are hurting you and the people that are doing that, that is not God's plan. God wants to help you. God loves you. God wants to rescue you from that. And God certainly wants to use those moments of tragedy and transform them into moments where you see his peace and you see his glory and you know that you're safe and you know that you're his child and you know that you can now safely walk all the way back home with him, like that prodigal son story. So first of all, I would say on a very practical side, if you're going through that, reach out and tell someone and talk about it and get it to stop. There are agencies that will intervene. There are people that have all sorts of help. There's Christian organizations that will help stand in that gap with you and help the abuse come to light and stop happening. And I hope that you have enough courage to do that. Please pray for the Lord to lead you and lead you out of that situation. I can understand the darkness you're feeling. I can understand what that feels like. But I want you to know that God is good and he is faithful and he has a plan for your future. And you just need to trust in that hope of Jesus. Get out of this situation. Tell someone. I'll even say this, fight back. Like that might be dangerous for some people, but like I chose to fight back. I didn't want to take it. So have the courage to say no. Maybe that looks different than how I did it, but like make it stop. You have the power to make it stop. And I want you to know that that's true. You have the power to make it stop either by reaching out and getting help. Like I said, there's all sorts of organizations that will help intervene. But mainly what I want you to know is that God loves you. And as trite as that may sound, that is what rescued me. He was trying to show me that in those moments. And he has shown me that every moment of the day as I trusted him all those years ago. Yeah.
I think the lie oftentimes is that there's nothing you can do about it and you just have to be alone. And the reality is that, you don't have to be alone. And there are people out there that care and will walk with you and help you. And so you don't have to be alone with God and you don't have to be alone with one another. And
that's right.
I think, and that changes the whole perspective of everything. If you're not isolated and alone, I think oftentimes you talked about, you know, you talked about your stepdad being kind of a predator, that is how they operate, is they isolate you and keep you alone so that you're helpless.
And that's how the enemy does it too in our spiritual life. He tries to isolate us and make us feel our own torment all alone so that we think there's no help.
Yeah. So there is hope, and there's hope. And I think that's what an important thing that is to know. And James, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know there's some tough stuff in there that you had to unpack today. And I think there's going to be people that listen to this that, hopefully they will walk away being encouraged and knowing that there's hope for them as well. So thanks for sharing.
I hope so too. Of course.
Thank you guys for listening. We're glad to have you guys back, and keep listening. We've got a lot more coming, lots more stories. I'm going to share my story in a future episode as well. And we've got a lot of great things still to come. So keep listening. Leave a review if you like the podcast so far and let us know. And you can shoot us an email as well. So thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Rockin' a Hard Place.
God bless you. We love you so much.
In light of the topic of today's episode, we would like to share with you the National Domestic Violence Hotline. If you or someone you care about is suffering from domestic violence, you can call 1-800-799-7233, or you can reach them online at thehotline.org/help. The National Sexual Assault Hotline can be reached at 1-800-656-4673 or online at hotline.rain.org. Finally, if you would like prayer or Christian counseling, you can reach our friends at the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association prayer line at 1-888-388-2683, or you can chat online at peacewithgod.net.